When our children were growing up and learning to read, they were assigned which way books. Have any of you read which way books? Nope. Well, maybe I can explain. If you've not heard of a which way book, they're books, primer reading books, that are given alternate endings. And as you read the book, you decide about three quarters through which page you want to go to for which ending. And it was kind of interesting. My sons would say, well, I didn't like that ending, so they went back to the other, you know, location and tried the other ending, see if they liked that better. And I thought it was pretty interesting. Of course, the purpose was to get young people to learn how to read and to have an interest in reading. But a secondary purpose, I believe, was to inform young people that when you make a certain decision, there are consequences to that decision, right? And it'd be wonderful in life if you could go back, if you made some bad decisions, to back it up and have a do-over. We've heard of do-overs, right? Kids do that all the time in games, you know, if they lose. My grandson is very prone to do that if he loses a game. Can we do that over? You know, he wants a do-over. I remember hearing story about Babe Ruth, famous baseball player who played for Boston and then the Yankees. As you know, he was famous for his home run hitting. And he was playing in this particular story in the World Series. I believe it was between the Yankees and the Red Sox. And the bases were loaded with two outs, and the count went to 2 balls, 3 strikes. And Babe Ruth was batting. And, of course, the crowd was standing, expecting he might hit the grand slam and win the game for the Yankees. And as the pitcher wound up and threw the fastball right down the middle, the Babe did not swing, and he was called out on strikes. And he mumbled something, which was unusual for Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth was known for his heavy drinking and even carousing with women that was in the paper all the time, but he did not curse. Kind of had that personal habit. You know, like Mike said, some of us have strengths in other areas and weaknesses in different areas. And so a lot of reporters, you know, they saw his lips moving, but they couldn't obviously hear him down on the field. And so they asked him what he said afterwards, and he just shook his head. He didn't want to say. So finally, they cornered the catcher, and they said, what did Babe Ruth say? And he said, well, it wasn't bad. And they said, well, what did he say? And the Babe said, I'd love to have that one back. I'd love to have that one back. He knew he had missed the perfect fastball pitch right down the middle that could have been struck out of the ballpark and a grand slam and a win for the Yankees. In real life, we can't go back and change the outcome of decisions or failures to make the right decisions, can we? I was chatting with Brent before services, and he asked what my title was, and I said, my title is, What If? What if? And he immediately brought up the first example I'm going to share with you today. What if Adam and Eve would have obeyed God and not eaten the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil? Have you thought about that? What if Adam and Eve would have obeyed God and not eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? I think God knew enough about human nature to realize that if it wasn't Adam and Eve, because they were free moral agents, they could have made a different decision than they did. But he knew eventually somebody wouldn't, and the plan of salvation that was planned before the foundations of the earth would need to be enacted. Christ would need to come as a human being and make the ultimate sacrifice. I mean, I think we all understand that. But what if Adam and Eve hadn't been the ones? Do you think that Adam and Eve probably sat around after they had made their big mistake and after they were cast out of the garden and perhaps even blamed one another for the bad decision? Or maybe even shared the desire, "Oh, I wish I had a do-over for that one." You think they might have that discussion? Knowing human nature, I've got a feeling they would have liked to have gone back and done it over again, picked a different ending to the book. On the other hand, Abraham and Sarah made a very good decision to follow God's instructions, even to the point of being willing to sacrifice his own son, their own son, Isaac. You remember the story, I'm sure, found in Genesis chapter 22, where Abraham was willing to follow God no matter what. As a result of that decision, there were some very positive and incredible blessings bestowed upon Abraham and Sarah, and some promises made to him that you and I are enjoying today. We live in these United States of America. We enjoy the blessings that were promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob because they obeyed God. They made the right decision. I don't think that Abraham ever sat around with Sarah and said, "You know, do you suppose we made the right decision?" I think they were pretty confident in their decision. I'd like to focus on a couple of other examples we find in the Bible and raise a question or two and maybe even raise a what if question. Let's go to Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy 34. Of course, the first five books of the Bible are credited to Moses. And Moses probably wrote most of it, but probably not all of it, but he compiled it into what we call the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. And here in the last chapter of this Pentateuch, we read something about Moses, which I think is pretty interesting. Verse 1, Deuteronomy 34, verse 1. "Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan." Now, Dan's way up in the north. And if you stand on the top of Mount Nebo on a clear day, you can look to your right, up way up north, as you look down over the Jordan Valley, and you can see Mount Hermon, which is just above Dan, the old tribe of Dan. It's a beautiful vista. If you ever have a chance to travel to Jordan, where Mount Nebo is today, I would highly recommend you go to Mount Nebo. Get that vista, that view. It's still there. It's probably changed a lot since Moses saw it. It's probably changed quite a bit since Noah saw it, too. God allowed Moses to go to the top of this mountain. It's about 3,000 feet in elevation. And you look down and you can see on a really clear day. I've never been there on a really, really clear day. But you can see all the way to the Mediterranean, I'm told. It's an incredible vista from there. Verse 2, "All of Naphtali and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh and all the land of Judah as far as the western sea," that is the Mediterranean, "and south and the plain of the valley of Jericho and the city of palm trees as far as Zoar." You can see all the way south, almost to the northern tongue of the Red Sea, coming up next to Egypt and Israel and Saudi Arabia today. It's kind of interesting. There's one point at the Red Sea where you can stand at the Gulf of Aqaba and you can look into four countries. It's pretty remarkable. You can look across and you can see into Egypt. You can look north and see into Israel. You can look northeast and you can see into Jordan, and you can look south and see into Saudi Arabia. And he could see all the way down there. Verse 4, "And the Lord said to him, 'This is the land of which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I said, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there. It's an interesting statement that God would allow him to see the carrot, but he couldn't go over Jordan to experience it. It was like the carrot on the stick, just out of reach. Why? Why would God say this to Moses, who's considered by one of the Jews, or the Jews, to be one of the great prophets? Why would he say this to Moses? What was it about Moses that God did not allow him to go into the promised land? Well, I'm not going to go back through the story. I think many of you are probably familiar with it, but Moses had an anger problem. We know he got very angry when he saw a taskmaster beating an Israelite slave. And his reaction was to kill the taskmaster. And he killed that man. And as a result, because he had killed a fellow Egyptian citizen, which he was at that time, he had to flee to the wilderness. And he fled to the wilderness. And I had to ask myself as I was reading this account and preparing this message, I wonder if those 40 years when he was wandering around the wilderness and working for his father-in-law and taking care of sheep and goats, if he didn't sit around a campfire at night and wonder about what if I had not lost my temper and killed that man? How would life be different than it is right now? Now, we know that God used that experience to train him. You know, if he could lead sheep around, he could certainly lead God's people around the wilderness, which he ended up doing. It was part of God's training period. But I often wonder, do you think God could not have extricated his children of Israel from Egypt another way? Think about that for a minute. Could there have been another way? What if he would have remained the general of Pharaoh's armies? The prince of Egypt. That's what he was. He was a trained military man. He knew how to kill. And he probably killed that man in anger. Another example we see in the wilderness as the Israelites are coming out. God told him when the Israelites were complaining about not having any water, he says, go over there and stand on that rock and I want you to hit it once. And we read the record that Moses was so angry with the children of Israel that he hit that rock over and over and over again. Water came rushing out, but God took note of the fact that this man has an anger problem. Moses had an anger problem, didn't he? Let's go to Exodus chapter 23. I'd like you to join me in kind of putting yourself in the position of Moses. God is giving directions here to the Israelites on how he wanted them to enter the promised land, and what he wanted them to do, and how he wanted them to act. Now, before we read here in Exodus chapter 23, verse 22, like I said, let's put ourselves in Moses' chair. He's probably got some regrets he's thought about in the wilderness. God is using him. He's a very dramatic servant of God. So there's been an incredible amount of miracles that have occurred up to this point. But who is Moses, really? We talked about it a little minute ago, at least I did. Moses was a Hebrew. He was rescued from the water, and he was trained in Pharaoh's court, and he was actually favored because he was the Pharaoh's adopted son, Pharaoh's daughter's adopted son, and he was trained as a prince and also as a general. He was a military man. If you will, he went to the military school. He went to the West Point of the Egyptian army. He was a commander of men. And apparently he was pretty good at it. Until he made that fatal error of killing a fellow Egyptian. So imagine yourself, you're this military general. And God tells you to tell the people this. Let's read this. Exodus 23, verse 22. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies, an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. So shall you serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sicknesses away from the midst of you. No one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite and the Canaanite and the Hittite from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land. Let's jump forward to 2019. Can you imagine? The commander of the Joint Chiefs of Staff asking all of the chiefs of staff of the four major forces, armed forces, to sit down at a table. And you might say, you know, guys, we're going to have a little different approach to what you've learned in military school. We're going to go in and we're going to conquer the promised land. But what we're going to do is we're going to fast and pray. And we're going to ask God to drive out the enemies in front of us. And he's going to do it with hornets. No swords, no spears. Bring it into the 21st century. No nuclear weapons, no arms, no AK-47s, no tanks. We're going to let God do it. This was God's intent. How do you think Moses reacted to that command? How do you think Moses reacted to the message that God was giving us? We're going to do this a little differently, Moses, than you've learned all these years, right? We're going to do this a little differently than you learned at West Point in the Egyptian capital, up in Thebes. We're going to do things a little differently. We're going to let God do it for us. There were slaves in Egypt for, almost 300 years? They had seen the military. They had noticed that the Egyptians had the biggest, strongest, meanest army in the world. The Egyptians were the most powerful nation on the earth at the time. They struggled back and forth. They had these battles between them and the Hittites, which were up in modern Turkey. And, you know, they used to meet for wars in the Valley of Armageddon, as we call it today, the Valley of Megiddo. That's where there was a plain there where they fought their wars between the Hittites and the Egyptians. And the Egyptians, they were number one. They were the biggest army in the world. In fact, if you go to visit many of those museums, whether it's in Istanbul or Cairo, you'll see big reliefs that have existed on the pillars of many buildings. And those reliefs picture soldiers and chariots fighting against each other. And their advance of arms was that the Hittites invented a chariot that held three guys, two fellows with bows and arrows, and one guy driving the chariot. And it was a lot more effective than the single chariot driver or even the double chariot driver. And so then they got more sophisticated weaponry. They got big chariots with several guys, several archers, and four horses. You know, they had these arms races that had to do with horses and chariots and more refined implements of war. But anyway, they were the best army in the world. So here you are. You're this proud general. Well, you've been humbled by 40 years in the wilderness. But God says, this is the way we're going to conquer the enemy. How do you think that went over? Well, not very well, because eventually the Israelites said, look, God, we don't want it to go that way. We don't want to march around a city seven times and blow the horns, blow the trumpets and see the walls fall down. We want to get out there and get a sword and get our arms bloody. We want to fight. And God said, are you sure you want to fight? God's original intent for taking the Israelites into the land was that they would not raise their sword. He said, you walk up to a walled city and those people will be so scared, you will see nothing but their backsides. That's what he said. We just read that. They'll take off. And he said, what I'm promising you is the promised land, but not just the land. He says, I'm promising you their cities and their houses and their vineyards and their orchards, because they're going to run from you. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that's a pretty good promise, don't you? But they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do it. Do you suppose after they met Amalek, the first nation that fought against them, do you suppose Moses ever had any regrets when they picked up the sword and did it their way instead of God's way? Oh, God gave them the victory, but God is a parent. You know, sometimes as parents, we just shake our heads. Our kids do it their way. They make a few mistakes, and we just shake our heads, but we love them, and we still stick with them, right? What if Moses had controlled his anger? Do you suppose God would have brought his people out of Egypt into the promised land anyway? Of course. Let's go to Exodus chapter 19. Back just a few pages, Exodus 19. Exodus 19, verse 4. Moses said this, you have seen, Exodus 19, verse 4. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people of all the earth, and it's mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. God's original intent for the Israelites was that they would not be a bloodthirsty, battling people. Read down here, on eagle's wings. That means under God's protection and blessing. I wish I felt like the United States of America was under God's protection and blessing today. I think there have been times in history it was. But not because of the modern Israelites. It was because of God's promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Special treasure is mentioned here. How is a special treasure a treasure to God? That's when you're confident you are God's special treasure. And you acknowledge that. You don't need to feel like you have to protect yourself. A kingdom of priests. Priests are associated with righteousness, a closeness to God. That's what God wanted of his people. He wanted them to be a kingdom of priests. Not just one tribe, but a whole kingdom. Of people who would be associated with righteousness and their closeness with God. A holy nation. Set apart. I will protect you because you are my special treasure. You don't need an army. That was his original intent. You don't need an army. This is the opposite of the way every other nation around them operated, including Egypt, from which they had been drawn out. I think we all know the history of warfare. It began back with Nimrod, who said, "I will be a protector for you. I am known as the mighty hunter. I will protect you from animals. I will protect you from other people." History is replete with examples and speculation about the fact that Nimrod built the first walled city. If you're under God's protection, you don't really need a walled city, do you? You can go right down history and see how the city-states eventually became walled cities, and those city-states grew, and they conquered other city-states, and they expanded into nations. The Egyptians, the Hittites, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, they all had the same model. If you had the stronger army and you conquered people and enslaved them into your army and into your workforce, then you were predominant, and you had to keep them dominated. That was the model that man adopted carnally very early on. But that's not the model that God wanted for his people. Go back to the original intent. He didn't want them to form an army. He didn't want them to arm themselves necessarily. He wanted them to be his special treasure. And a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. What if the Israelites would have done it differently? What if they would have been the example nation God called them out to be? How long would they have maintained that status? What if they had followed God's original intent? I'd like us to look at a second example. That's the example of David. Let's go to 1 Chronicles 28. 1 Chronicles 28 and verse 3. 1 Chronicles 28, verse 3. David speaking here, he says, "But God said to me, 'You shall not build a house for my name.'" How disappointing that must have been for David. From the time that David was a little boy and he saw God's tent being carried around, and his dad took him there during the Feast of Tabernacles to see the tent that was set up in Shiloh, and how that they probably had to repair it from time to time, how much he yearned to build a house for God. He went through 40 years of kingship with that in the back of his head. He drew the plans. He had architects draw it up. He had planned on where to put it. He'd bought the land for it. He had prepared his whole life to build the temple to God. And he records here, "But God said to me, 'You shall not build a house for my name.'" Why? Why wouldn't God let David build his temple? Well, read the rest of the verse. "Because you have been a man of war and have shed blood." Because you have been a man of war and shed blood. David wasn't afraid of much. You know, we read that even when he was a shepherd boy, a child, he killed a lion and a bear. He knew how to use a sling. He knew how to protect his flock. But, you know, after he got into Saul's presence and he saw the military might of Saul and his sons, and he saw the army of Israel, and then after he was pushed out of Saul's presence and he thought to defend himself and his gang of men, he began to be a warrior. He led men of war. They fought a guerrilla warfare against the common enemy with Israel and Saul. That was the Philistines. He was a man of war who shed blood. Let's read on, verse 4. However, the Lord God of Israel chose me above all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever. And he has chosen Judah to be the ruler, and of the house of Judah and the house of my father and among the sons of my father, he was pleased with me to make me king over all of Israel. And of all my sons, for the Lord has given me many sons, he has chosen my son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. Verse 6. Now he said to me, it is your son Solomon who shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. Moreover, I will establish his kingdom forever, if he is steadfast to observe my commandments and my judgments, as it is this day. What if Solomon had done what he asked God to give him to do, use the wisdom of God's Spirit to lead the people of Israel? What if? Do you suppose after God had this discussion with David, that David had some regrets? The fact that he was a man of war, that he'd shed a lot of blood? Do you think he thought about what if? What if I hadn't done it this way? Then wouldn't God then allow me to build this temple to him? What if? Let's go to 2 Samuel, 2 Samuel chapter 16. There's an interesting encounter here that I think is fascinating in this vein of thought. 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 5. Shortly after David becomes king, 2 Samuel 16, verse 5, there's a man who served on the cabinet of Saul, a Benjamite. His name is Shimei. And there's an interesting encounter here between David and Shimei that I think deserves our attention as we think about this. 2 Samuel 16, verse 5. Now when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there, and he came out cursing continuously as he came. He wasn't cursing God, as we shall read here. And he threw stones at David and all the servants of King David and all the people and all the mighty men who were on the right hand and on his left. So David was walking with his entourage, probably of soldiers, men that had been loyal to him. You know, they were known as men of war, all of them. And also Shimei said thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. I like the way the New King James puts it. You bloodthirsty rogue. Shimei was cursing the king. Called him a bloodthirsty rogue. Verse 8. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you are caught in your own evil because you are a bloodthirsty man. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please let me go over and take off his head. That sounds like a peace-loving comment from a general, doesn't it? When you go back and you look at the geography of this place, it's kind of interesting because there's a valley. It's actually called the Valley of Jezreel. And on one side is the Mount of Olives. On the other side is the Temple Mount. You can actually walk on both sides of this valley. And unless there's a bridge, you can't get across. There's the creek Kidron right in the bottom of it. And so you can look across this valley. It's only about maybe 100, 150 yards. And you could yell at somebody on the other side, and they couldn't get to you pretty quickly before you could get away. You know what I mean? It's like being on one side of the canyon yelling at somebody on the other side of the canyon, and that's what Shimei was doing to David. You bloodthirsty rogue! And so Abishai says, David, you give me the word, I will get across this canyon, and I will take that guy's head off. Please let me go over and take off his head. Now verse 10, but the king said, What do I really have to do with you, you sons of Zariah? Let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. Who then shall say, why have you done so? David basically said, he's right. Shimei is right. And God has inspired him to remind me that he's right and that I am indeed a man of war and bloodthirsty. Do you suppose David may have had some feelings of regret the way he had lived his life to this point? Do you suppose he may have thought, What if I had made a different decision when I knew that God had anointed me? Samuel laid that oil on my head. I knew I was going to be king. If I had taken maybe a little different path, could God have still made me king? Or did I need to protect myself? Did I need to arm myself? Did I need to surround myself with an army? Oh, it's kind of filled his ego, you know, when all the women were singing songs about, you know, Saul has killed his thousands, but David, he's killed 10,000. It was an ego trip, but I think in a moment like this we just read about, the reality hit David. What if David had allowed God to fulfill his promise of the kingdom to David and his descendants instead of David taking matters into his own hands? What if? I thought about this a whole lot on July 4th of this year, last Thursday. I like picnics. I like hamburgers. I like hot dogs. I like fireworks. But I had to think, what if our forefathers had believed the Bible, had total faith in God, and truly believed that God was going to raise up a great nation in North America as he had promised? What if they had been more patient? A lot of people say, well, those forefathers, you know, like Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and some of those guys, they were so close to God. You better go back and read history, folks. These were people who had mistresses on the continent of Europe, people who had mistresses among their slaves, people who lived immoral lives, people who wielded power over other people. It indeed is far different than history would record in our glorious annals. What if they had really believed God? But instead, of course, they raised up an army, the Continental Army. Why did they feel the need to arm themselves and fight a conventional war with muskets at the time, bayonets and cannons against the British? What if? Would history be different? Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. I'd like to rehearse this conversation that Samuel had with the Israelites when they didn't want a judge to rule over them anymore. They said, look, we don't want somebody that God has picked. We want to pick somebody to rule over us. We want to pick a king like everybody else around us. Everybody else has got a king. We've got a bunch of judges. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you're old. Your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now, therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people and asked for a king. And he said in verse 11, "This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them as his own, for his own chariots, and to be his horsemen, and some to run before his chariot." Basically, he's saying, look, the king is going to form an army, and he's going to take your kids, your children. Verse 12, "He will appoint captains over his household, over his thousands, and captains over fifties, and set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and sow, some of to make his weapons of war and equip his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields," etc., etc. He'll tax you. "He'll take your sons, he'll tax you. He'll take more tax." In spite of the warning, they said, "We want a king. Give us a king. We want that big guy, that warrior, who stands 8 or 9 inches above everybody else in Israel. Big guy, Saul. We want Saul." Because he was a big warrior. What if the Israelites had made a little different decision and said, "You know, God's right. I don't want to lose my sons. I don't want my daughter-in-laws to be widows. I don't want my wife to be a widow." What if they would have said, "I don't want to give the produce that God has blessed me with, other than that 10%, you know, to God. I don't want to give taxes to the king." What if they had heeded the admonition of God through the mouth of Samuel the servant? Let me share a few facts with you. I found this on battlefields.org, if you'd like to look it up. Talked about the Revolutionary War. It says throughout the course of the war, the Revolutionary War, an estimated 6,800 Americans were killed in action. 6,100 were wounded, and upwards of 20,000 were taken prisoner by the British. Historians believe that at least an additional 17,000 deaths were the result of disease while fighting, including about 8,000 who died while prisoners of war. A total of 30,000 deaths during the Revolutionary War of Americans. Data from Britain places the casualties for Britain or British regulars fighting in the Revolutionary War around 24,000 men. This total number includes battlefield deaths and injuries, deaths from disease, men taken prisoner, and those who remained missing. Additionally, about 12,000 Hessen, that is, German mercenaries, were killed. It is estimated, since the Revolutionary War, that 1,264,000 American soldiers have died in combat in this nation's wars. The population of San Diego or Dallas has been killed in American wars since the Revolutionary War. since that decision was made by our forefathers. Some might argue that we would be speaking German now if we had not been fighting in World War I or II, right? Fair argument, but the fact is, out of those 1.2 million plus casualties, 750,000, more than half, died in our Civil War. English people speaking English, killing other English people. In some cases, brothers and sisters. 1.2 million is equal to the current population of Dallas or San Diego. I mentioned that already. 120,000 young men, U.S. soldiers, have died in wars and conflicts since World War II. Just wars, they've been called. Stopping the advance of communism, dictators, radical terrorists, and we see how well that's worked out. What about the cost in terms of resources? The U.S. of America defense budget for this coming year is $718 billion, about 4% of our GDP. Do you think Samuel was right? The number two country, we're the number one country, by the way, in defense spending. The number two country is China. They spend approximately $250 billion a year. America spends three times that for defense. The number three country, it might surprise you, in defense spending is Saudi Arabia. $68 billion a year. Number four is India with $67 billion. What if our forefathers had believed the Bible, had total faith in God, and truly believed that God was going to raise up a nation as He had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Could God have fulfilled His promise without that great loss of life? I think so, don't you? Is God's hand shortened, as he said? On July 1st, 1867, the British Parliament gave independence to Canada. It was 92 years later than the U.S. Declaration of Independence and the beginning of the Revolutionary War. 92 years, if we go a day for a thousand, a thousand years like a day in the eyes of God, that would have been less than 2 hours in God's eyes. 2 hours later, our forefathers were impatient, that's for sure. 92 years after our Declaration of Independence and the Revolutionary War, Canada gained its independence from Britain. Do you think Canada's independence is a part of the blessings that were promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? I do. Absolutely. Canada has a holiday and they have fireworks on July 1st every year to celebrate their independence. It's called Dominion Day. It was when they were founded as a dominion separate from the British. But it does not represent war. Have you heard the expression, the rockets, red glare, the bombs bursting in air? It means something different to Americans, those fireworks. In Canada, it's a celebration of thankfulness for becoming a nation. Now, I don't happen to believe that Canada is following God any more than America. It's very socialistic there. I lived there for 10 years. I know what it was like, what it is like. But what if our forefathers had believed the Bible, had total faith in God, and truly believed that God was going to raise up a great nation as He had promised? The United States of America is a warrior nation. Dare I say, bloodthirsty nation? I love living here. I love the blessings that we enjoy. But just like Shimei, Facts is facts, as they say. And David told his general, leave him alone. He's telling the truth. Let's go to Isaiah 59, verse 8. I'd like to read a couple of prophecies. Isaiah 59 and verse 8. Isaiah 59 and verse 8. Although we claim that our military might is defensive and we are creating peace, that is not, in fact, the case. We've been mired in a war in Afghanistan for 18 years now. Have we brought peace to that region of the world? Currently, there are 40 wars going on in this world. 40. America is involved in several of them, in one degree or another. Some of those wars and conflicts have been going on for longer than I have been alive. 75, 80 years, some of those conflicts have been going on without a solution. Isaiah 59, verse 8 says, the way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. That's the truth. We have made decisions, whether it was the founding fathers of the United States of America, whether it was the children of Israel in the face of a choice between the judges and the kings, whether it was David, whether it was Moses. We have made some bad choices, haven't we? And history bears us out. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall not know peace. Peace has never been gained by military might. They talk about the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. It never came about. Not really. There was always trouble here, trouble there, a rebellion here, a rebellion there. There was always war, even in the Roman Empire, which was to bring ultimate peace. To bring ultimate peace. But it never happened. Brethren, you and I know that there's only one way that peace will be brought to this earth. Don't we? Let's go to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 2. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. Now it came to pass, it shall come to pass, rather, in the latter days. Isaiah 2, 2. That the mountain of the Lord's house, that is, the kingdom of God, shall be established on the top of all the mountains, all the countries, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations will flow to it. Not just look to it for leadership, but look to it for peace. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. All the great military colleges will be shut down. When nations rise up against Christ, which they will, what kind of warfare do you suppose Christ will engage? You think he'll throw on his AK-47 and say, go, let's charge against the enemy? Do you think he will say, like I've heard some even in God's church say, let's nuke them? Let's nuke them and resurrect them in the second resurrection. Is that what God will do? Is that what Christ will do? How will he fight? A conventional warfare? All you have to do is turn over to Zechariah chapter 14 and It spells it out pretty clearly there. In verse 4, Zechariah 14:4, it says, God will create a large earthquake to swallow his enemies. Boy, that would slow down an army, wouldn't it? Give them a 7.1. Slow them down a little bit. Okay, they're still coming. Let's give them a 8. Open up the earth. Swallow the first few companies of men. God is not going to lift a rifle. He's not going to shoot off a bomb. He's not going to blast with conventional warfare of any kind. Jesus Christ and his saints will have infinite power over the powers of nature. Like I said, that would certainly slow down an advancing army, wouldn't it? You go to Zechariah 14, verse 6, and it said, God will cause it to be dark in the day and bright light at night. When do most armies like to attack? At night. You can see this army getting ready. We're going to fight Christ. Let's wait till dark falls. And God says, okay, I'm going to leave the light on. Hey, think about it for a minute. Have power over nature. Be able to control. Read the minds of those advancing generals and say, we're going to change your mind. You want to come in at dawn? There will not be a dawn today. Zechariah 14, verse 17 says, okay, you guys want to rebel? How about no rain? How about no water? Still don't want to come up? Okay, I'm going to send a plague. I have never seen an advancing army with any efficiency move forward without water and with dysentery, where you can't get more than 5 or 10 feet from a toilet. It's not a very effective army, is it? God knows how to fight battles if people want to fight. Zechariah 14:12, he says, if they still are rebellious, then their skin will begin to melt. Their eyes will not see anymore. Their tongues will dissolve in their heads. That's not conventional warfare. God said, I know how to drive those people out of the promised land before you. I'll send a bunch of bees inside their armor and see how effective they are. Right? He says, I've got ways that can be effective and can change people's minds like that. Makes you wonder, what if? Doesn't it? Let's finally go to Isaiah 9, verse 6. Isaiah 9, verse 6. For unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. Obviously talking about Christ. And the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, Everlasting Father, that is the Father of Israel, Prince of Peace. One of the titles of Jesus Christ coming to this earth to establish his kingdom is the Prince of Peace. He will bring peace, as they say, peace will break out in the kingdom of God. Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice. From that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Brethren, you and I read this book, and we know the end of the book, don't we? There is no alternate ending to God's book. We know that eventually peace will come to this earth, but not the way man has devised in his heart to bring about peace. It will not come that way. It will only come one way. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I like fireworks. I don't know if we will have fireworks in the kingdom of God, but some very creative people make some beautiful fireworks in the air, don't they? If we do, this I know, that they will not represent war. If anything, they will represent the end of all wars and the joy of universal peace.